This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanksgiving is a time to get together with family and friends and a celebration of food. Turkey may be the tradition, but it's not for everyone. Hari Pulapaka is the executive chef at Crest Restaurant in DeLand. Thank you so much for coming back to Intersection.
My pleasure, Matthew. Always great to be here.
So Thanksgiving, for most folks in the United States, turkey is the thing they think about for Thanksgiving. What does Thanksgiving mean to you, though?
Well, I'm a first-generation immigrant, and I came from India, and I've gone through a few iterations of Thanksgiving with my American friends and now adopted family. But to me, it's a larger way of celebrating food and thinking about food. It's certainly a food holiday, mm-hmm. and I'd like to call this week America's Food Week. And now that I'm a professional chef and having been one for so long, I'd like to think of it as a time to reinforce the idea of cooking from scratch and, you know, bringing family and friends together to the not just the common table but also to the common kitchen. And I think food is best enjoyed when everyone's in it together as much as they can be and want to be. Mm-hmm. So in a very simplistic way, it's a time for family and friends and food that's thoughtful and meaningful and at the very least brings all of us together at the common table. And then we can, you know, take it beyond that and think of traditional food and football and all that kind of stuff.
When you first moved to the United States, was that the first time you ate turkey?
When I first moved there, I was a vegetarian. So anything meat-related was the first time I'd had it, for sure. The first time I had turkey, actually, I think, was the first time I ate in this country formally. My host family took me to a rather large buffet in Radford, Virginia, because I was attending Virginia Tech 2 weeks into my stay here. And I remember this gigantic, you know, four times as big as Golden Corral kind of a place. Mm-hmm. And I was completely intimidated by how much food there was. And I had no clue about how to attack the food or what to put on a plate. And so I just took a wild guess. And I recall taking a piece of turkey. I thought it was chicken, but it wasn't. It was turkey. And it tasted rather different from the chicken I had imagined, even though I had never eaten meat before. So yeah, that was the first time I ate turkey. And then since then, you know, I've cooked turkey many a time. In a moment of trying to be healthier, I might gravitate more towards turkey versus chicken. But in the grand scheme of things, I don't think I've really eaten turkey that much in my life, frankly. Mm-hmm. You know, chicken probably a lot more than turkey.
If you were to cook the full Monty, so to speak, the traditional Thanksgiving turkey, how would you do it?
So I treat it like a really large bird, which is what it tends to be, typically, right? So there's a classic way of cooking a whole turkey with stuffing under the skin and all those aromatic flavored butters and things like that, and putting it over a mirepoix of vegetables and herbs and what have you, and then just doing the proper two-step process of trying to get some crisp followed by some full cooking. But I would think that the next time I cook a whole turkey, I would probably dissect the parts and mm-hmm. cook the different parts differently, because I think you're able to control more how it happens and what flavors you can impart to the different aspects. Because I feel like even though people go to great lengths to really make elaborate stuffings and brinings and marinating and all of that stuff with their big bird, I really don't think that translates to this wow necessarily at the table. Mm-hmm. So I feel like as a chef, if I'm able to take the white meat away from the dark meat and take some of the even offal meat away from the dark meat and to cook all of those things differently in the way that I would normally cook those organs or those parts, I'm able to present that same turkey, of course, dissected, but also celebrated in ways that gastronomically make sense.
The image, though, or the appearance is kind of important, though. Right? People, in some ways, might expect to see the gleaming bird, you know, the roasted whole bird. How do you get around that?
You're absolutely correct, and they probably do, but that's where food styling comes into play a little bit, and you can, frankly, garnish a centerpiece that consists mostly of different parts of the bird in a number of ways to, I would argue, a more dramatic presentation. So height, color, textures. In fact, having a platter of food where there's so much diversity of preparation, I think has the chance of being even more dramatic.
Mm-hmm. For chefs and restaurant owners, is there a bit of a kind of tension around holidays like Thanksgiving? Because a lot of people like to go out and eat on Thanksgiving, rather holidays, but for yourself, I mean, you might want to take a break. You might want to give your staff a day off, time to celebrate with family. How do you balance the two?
That is absolutely a valid point, and frankly, it's something I refer to quite a bit when I try to describe what the profession's like to people who may not know what that profession's like or what it entails. Essentially, in the restaurant business, we get to work when everyone else wants to play or get to play, and holidays are no different. So, especially, but the difference between holidays and typical weekends, where that's still the case, with weekends, okay, you can still kind of catch up and move on with your normal life. But with holidays, it sort of appears only, you know, those days only appear so many times a year, sometimes just once a year, for example, mm-hmm. for Thanksgiving and Christmas. So to miss that out entirely with in the way you would normally function that day and enjoy that day if you were not in the profession does take its toll over a long period of time. And I know a lot of young cooks, at least, get very disgruntled and very frustrated at the fact that, you know, essentially that they have to be cooped up in a kitchen, no pun intended.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty talking with Hari Pulapaka. He's the executive chef at Chris Restaurant in DeLand, talking about Thanksgiving. One other thing that I've read about is that turkeys are getting a bit smaller. Is that something you've noticed as a chef?
I have when I paid attention. I do think turkeys are getting smaller, which I think speak a little bit to perhaps the slight shift in the way mass big food is being produced. So they're getting smaller, I suspect would mean that we're pumping less stuff into them. Mm-hmm. We're letting them grow a little bit more naturally, perhaps.
And is that because people want that they're more concerned with flavor than appearance?
Absolutely. And you know, I mean, I'm always distraught at the lack of flavor in grocery store products. It's always amazing to me. And a turkey would be no different. I mean, it's quite impressive how large these things get. Mm-hmm. And how big they are and what a dramatic presentation they provide for the dinner table or the lunch table. And then that's what I spoke to earlier, and tried to dissect the different parts and cook them differently and control that flavor actually does justice to the animal, the bird in this case, if you will. Mm-hmm. But just roasting a whole bird, it's already bland to begin with, and to try to really get it to any kind of flavor intensity takes a lot of effort and technique and skill. But to answer your question about the birds getting smaller each year, seemingly, I think that's true. And I, if it's for the reasons that I'm thinking as to why they're getting smaller, I'm celebrating already, because that to me tells me that we're perhaps in some small way as an industry getting back to flavor before volume and mm-hmm. making the most bang for the buck.
Talking about flavor and appearance, one of the things you do is you focus on so-called trash fish, right? Like fish which may not look cool. They may not be popular fish to put on the dinner table, but they taste pretty good. Is there something similar going on in the poultry business?
Well, I don't know if that's along the same lines, but I do think, and to the equivalent to me, the analog would be to look at other kinds of birds or other kinds of species. But the fact that the birds today are seemingly smaller and perhaps more flavor-packed, I think speaks as much to the fact that there's more demand. And you look at every big corporation that has anything to do with food, and they're promoting their sustainability statements, and they're talking about the better practices that they have in place, and they're thinking about the planet, and they're thinking about the future, not just the bottom line as we've always thought they did. So I'm hoping that's the case, and that makes me feel good. But I do think, having said that, there's a lot of food waste in this country. Mm-hmm. And so at the very least, when these birds are so large and it's a family of two trying to consume a 15-pound bird, you know, there's bound to be some boredom after day four. Mm-hmm. And you're probably going to not consume everything you had. And there's probably some waste there. So that's always a travesty and a tragedy. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that these smaller sized ingredients allow us to perhaps consume them better and consume them more wholesomely and fully, and possibly then resulting in a smaller food waste quotient, if you will. So that's a good thing as well.
For folks who are vegetarian or even vegan, is it a challenge? Is it an opportunity?
Absolutely, both. It's definitely a challenge because despite all of the activism and the awareness about vegetarianism and plant-based food in this country, it's still woefully lacking in many ways, and chefs are just as guilty of that as members of the household. because there's not necessarily an education, it is not a training, there's not a commitment, there's not necessarily an awareness of what all could be done with plant-based ingredients. So it definitely presents both an opportunity as well as a challenge, the challenge being essentially that you don't quite have that dramatic array of food that everybody else has. The opportunity then is just that, is quite the complement of that. It allows chefs who care, I do, for example, to reach a little bit deeper into your repertoire and your arsenal to try to figure out ways to make that food more meaningful. And I recently joked, I saw this video going through Facebook. I can't help but mention it, about somebody presenting a big giant cabbage, glazed and roasted and glazed many times and marinated and glazed one more time and presented as a centerpiece, mm-hmm. as for the vegetarian at the house. And the tagline was something like this: if this won't bring the vegans to the Thanksgiving table, you know, I don't know what will. And it was this really dramatic, really caramelized, golden brown, highly glazed cabbage. So my comment there was simply, well, that's a lot of drama for a big roasted vegetable, mm-hmm. because I don't think that necessarily is what this is about. I mean, that's not what a vegetarian is looking for.
Right.
That's not the equivalent of spending 10 hours brining a turkey and stuffing it with everything imaginable and then carving it quite dramatically at the table and on making these leftover things for days on end. Mm-hmm. That roasted cabbage doesn't do justice to what those other people do with that.
Can you make up a full Thanksgiving meal with just the trimmings and the sides, though?
Oh, my. Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, I don't see why you can't serve a big, dramatic vegetarian Wellington or quote-unquote meatloaf as a centerpiece. And one carves into it, and it's really rich and decadent, and it oozes, you know, flavor. And then the side dishes are actually, I mean, I always think of bacon as being a crutch. I might get admonished and scolded by my colleagues for saying that, but I don't think bacon's always necessary in everything. It's definitely a crutch that a lot of chefs use to create flavor when they don't know how to create flavor otherwise. So a lot of the sides that are traditional at the Thanksgiving table tend to also still have those drippings and all of that kind of stuff, and they're completely unnecessary in my opinion. You can create, I mean, think of it this way. The country of India has, you know, about 350 million vegetarians, possibly.
That's quite a few.
Right? That's quite a few. And so we have food-related festivals year-round. And we have quite dramatic spreads all year-round. And it's such a diversity of food. We don't miss a big, giant bird in the middle of the table to make our meal feel festive or celebratory. So I think there's a lot to learn from cultures like that, how to make a dinner table dramatic for everyone, including vegetarians, because you don't have to always lean on a giant protein to make the statement. I know it comes from a certain place in history, why that happens and how food is presented that way, but I think there are a lot of cultures around the world, in India specifically, so I'm fortunate that I can say that I have that experience, where you can really create quite a dramatic array of dishes that will be considered a feast by any measure.
Hari Pulapaka is the executive chef at Chris Restaurant in DeLand. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you as well. What are you going to have for Thanksgiving?
That is a good question. I'm not actually in charge of cooking, so I guess I'll find out.
Fair enough.
To be determined, but I'm sure it'll be good, by the way. That interview first aired on Intersection last November. Still to come, uncovering the secret lives of pets with veterinarian Dr. Lynn Honickman. We revisit a conversation about the challenges of understanding your pet. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Pets are a big part of life in America. According to the North American Veterinary Community, some 85 million households in this country have a pet, with cats the most popular. The cost of keeping a pet isn't cheap. Americans spent about $40 billion on healthcare for their pets last year. But there's also evidence that having a pet in your life can improve your quality of life and your health. Well, we're joined by Dr. Lynn Honickman. She is a veterinarian. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also joined by Tom Bond. He is the CEO of NAVC. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you.
So, Lynn, there are a lot of pets in the United States, right? Some 85 million households with pets. That's a lot of people
with pets. It's a lot of people with pets. Mm-hmm. We can't live without them.
And when did cats overtake dogs?
Just a couple of years ago. So it's probably lifestyle situations and maybe some people who work long hours think they're easier.
What kind of pets do you primarily deal with?
So I mostly work with dogs and cats, but I also will see exotics. I'm a general veterinarian who sees only behavior problems. Mm-hmm. So the patients that I see are very troubled, and mostly dogs and cats, but I'll see some birds, some guinea pigs, some ferrets.
What does a guinea pig with behavioral issues present like?
Well, a family might have a guinea pig that's biting them, and certainly that's not what's thought of as a good pet. Mm-hmm. And guinea pigs live with a lot of children. So sometimes, so typically those kinds of issues are often handling and management problems. So sometimes it's educating the family as to how to address the needs of the guinea pig in a way that's not going to scare them.
Do you see some kind of pet trends too? Like one year it might be like pot-bellied pigs are trendy, or maybe the next year it's like canaries or something. Like what kind of pets are in these days?
Well, absolutely. And so that often goes along with movies, right? So when Disney comes out with 101 Dalmatians and everybody wants a Dalmatian, we were joking with Tom earlier that he has an old English sheepdog. And so if you're old enough to know, you know, the Shaggy Dog movies, you know, you might think of that.
Well, Tom, tell me about your role and maybe some of the changes you've seen in kind of people's pet choices and the place that pets play in people's lives these days.
Yeah, I mean, if you put it in perspective, and you mentioned the fact that 85 million households, I mean, it's just an incredibly enormous number, but $40 billion are spent each year on our pets' healthcare. And what's so significant about that is the fact that pets have become such an important part of our everyday lives. So you always see the stories about service dogs and all the heroics and the incredible things that they're doing to support people with PTSD and other types of things. But the reality is that they're helping people every day within their family. So we've been working with the human-animal bond focus of this whole thing, which is really showing that pets have significant positive health impacts across the board. And we're talking about reduced blood pressure, better commitment to taking their medications. You know, we were just at an event a couple weeks ago, and the former Surgeon General, Dr. Murthy, mm-hmm. He was talking about the fact that loneliness is an epidemic right now in the United States, believe it or not. And he said that the impact of loneliness was equivalent or greater than 14 cigarettes a day. I mean, could you imagine that for just a second? And he said one of the key ways to deal with that is pet ownership, because pets can bring so much to your life. It gives you a purpose every day. And all of our research has shown that. So we really have gone from this, you know, I remember we were talking in the lobby about when I was a kid, you would see dog houses in people's backyards. Well, mm-hmm. You don't see that anymore. Dogs are very much, and cats, integrated into the family household, and so important at every single level to the family.
Tom, did you grow up in Florida?
I didn't grow up in Florida. I actually grew up in New York, which was mm-hmm. probably another reason for the doghouse. But those cold, brutal winters, you know, mm-hmm. you don't see that anymore. You see absolute immersion into the overall family. They're basically, we call them the owners, pet parents now. Mm-hmm. We don't call them dog owners or cat owners. They're pet parents, because for a lot of people, we're having, by the way, I don't know if you saw this, for the first time, Americans are having less kids. A big part of that, I think, is that they're finding real value and completeness from owning these pets.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty, speaking to Tom Bond. He's the CEO of the NAVC. Also talking to Dr. Lynn Honickman, veterinarian. Lynn, what about that companion animal? Is it a bit of a fine line for vets to tread if somebody says, look, I really get some value out of my companionship with whatever animal it is, but at the same time, there are people who have specific needs. They may need a seeing eye dog. They may need an animal for helping them with PTSD. And there are other people who are just like, I want to take my cockatoo on a plane. And maybe they're pushing those boundaries a wee bit.
Right. The boundaries absolutely need to be respected, because there are people who need service dogs for specific skills. So we kind of categorize them into service dogs versus emotional support dogs versus therapy dogs. A therapy dog is the easiest dog that just kind of visits people in hospitals, or is specially trained and has good manners and has good social skills and can visit VA hospitals and things mm-hmm. like that, which has a great benefit to a lot of people. Service dogs absolutely help people who have vision issues, physical issues. And so those dogs can perform a specific skill and are absolutely allowed to go places with those families. And yet emotional support dogs, the actual distinction of what their rights are is very blurry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's really only one that's recognized by the ADA. which is really for disabilities, and they have to be actually trained to provide something for them and actually be able to do that act. Mm-hmm. So that's where it became kind of a little blurry when people right. were just saying, well, I need my puppy here because, you know.
It helps me feel better.
It helps me feel better. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think we need to be a lot more focused on people who truly are in need versus I just want to travel with my pet. One of the reasons we started the Human-Animal Bond Certification through NAVC was to really begin the conversation of what these pets mean, what the responsibility is, and to give veterinarians really the tools to understand, because they're doctors. They're highly trained, incredibly smart doctors. And just like human doctors, some of the things that they're not necessarily exposed to as much as they should be is bedside manner. And so mm-hmm. if you look at the equivalent. So what the Human-Animal Bond Certification really helps them work through is these pets are practically children for a lot of people. How do you have the conversations with them about care? How do you have the conversations with them about, you know, end-of-life care or other types of things which are going to be coming up or become really important. And that's, I think, why this certification was so important. These are all things that veterinarians kind of know, but it kind of brings it all together, I think, in a way that they're able to have those communications with the pet parents.
So, Dr. Honigman, is this certification, is it effectively like saying you are able to kind of talk to the humans in the human-pet relationship about this? Like, what does it actually mean?
Right. What it will allow is for everyone to understand the role that animals play in our lives. And from a behavior aspect, you know, we see the results of that broken relationship. So when a pet has behavior problems, we see a deterioration of the human-pet bond. And mm-hmm. that's exactly what we're talking about. And if yeah. we can understand our pets better, if we can understand that maybe they were abandoned at some point, maybe they didn't have the right kind of start in life. Maybe they came from a puppy mill. And so they have issues. And if we can understand those issues and we can address them from a medical standpoint and not just think of them as naughty or bad dogs, mm-hmm. Then we can help enhance that bond and we can be on a better playing field, a better understanding of what do the humans need in this relationship? What does the pet need in this relationship? And how do we serve everybody?
Are people getting better at not abandoning their pet if they think it has an issue that they can't resolve? Like, is that kind of conversation become any easier?
No, actually, behavior problems are still the number one reason that animals end up in shelters and rescue groups, because that behavior problem, and it might just be a dog that barks all day long, which is actually a medical issue if that mm-hmm. dog is barking all day long, or it could be that they're biting children who visit the house, which is an extremely serious issue. And so behavior problems are the number one reason that animals are relinquished, much more so than other medical problems. And so animals are losing their lives at very early ages, so between 1 and 5 years old, because of behavior problems. Mm-hmm. If we can get them through those behavior problems, then we can have a nice dog that lives a good long time.
As you say, you know, a dog that is biting children or other visitors to a house, that's pretty serious.
Absolutely.
Can that behavior be trained out, or is there a way to sort of work through that?
Right. So we're not talking about training, because in training we talk about mostly just, you know, good social manners and nuisance behaviors and jumping on the counter and things like that. So mm-hmm. Aggression and biting is often anxiety related. And so we're really talking about the brain at that point.
So is it medication?
Absolutely. It can be. So medication can be a part of that. We're looking at the brains exactly as we look at mental illness in people. And so mm-hmm. what is causing this anxiety? What is causing this trigger reaction? And so we are addressing it with a full treatment plan that includes how we manage that situation so that everyone stays safe and so the animal doesn't feel threatened. And then behavior modification is different in training in that we're just trying to change the emotional response. We're mm-hmm. not trying to get the dog to sit or stay or lie down. We're trying to get the dog to feel better about the situation.
But the tricky thing is you can't talk to the dog. I
right.
mean, you can communicate to a certain level, but you can't put the dog on the psychiatrist's couch and say, how are you feeling about this?
Well, that's essentially what I do, though, every day. So as a behavior vet, I am, you know, welcome to my parlor, right? You know, tell me what your troubles are. And so mm-hmm. we're looking at what caused this issue, but also how do we move forward? And so we move forward by positive reinforcement and creating positive associations. So if you're afraid of an unfamiliar man, okay, well, let's start teaching you that unfamiliar people actually predict great things. So every time at a great distance you see an unfamiliar man, I might feed you chicken, and that might be a really good thing. So if you see that man, you get chicken. And so
that's a pretty high bar for the dog.
Right? Well, so pretty soon you might walk around, you know, the dog might look for men because that that man might predict something really delicious. So mm-hmm. we want to try and change that emotional response. We also want to teach that animal how to be calm. And so we actually do a lot of deep relaxation breathing, so similar to biofeedback in people, mm-hmm. Just how to calm that brain, how to calm that cortisol, how to get that adrenaline down. And so a lot of it is very similar in how we work with and address these issues in people.
What about when a pet dies? I mean, that's got to be tough for the human family of that pet, whether it's a dog, whether it's a cat, whether it's a bird, you know, any kind of pet. I mean, and as Tom is saying, they're way more integrated into people's lives now. So how much of what you do also involves helping kind of counsel the human family of the dog, the cat, whoever it is?
That's a huge part of what veterinarians do on a daily basis, which is also why the stress level in the veterinary industry, the veterinary profession, is so high, because we are dealing with life and death on a daily basis and in a very different way. We are seeing these pets as a general practitioner from the time that they're puppies and kittens until their last days. Mm-hmm. Very few family doctors treat humans from the time that they're babies until the time that they're seniors. And so we are literally cradle to grave, and
You develop a bond with the pet,
exactly,
too.
Exactly, right. So mm-hmm. 10, 15 years of being that pet's and that family's veterinarian is quite emotional. And so, yes, we help families ease that transition. Children, you know, we help them. And then the other pets in the household absolutely can grieve as well. So mm-hmm. I know when we lost my dog at 16, my cat was 17, and for a full month, she very much grieved the loss of her buddy. And, you know, people don't think dogs and cats get along that well, but she was definitely mourning that loss. And mm-hmm. some studies have come out and shown that humans will often mourn the loss of a pet more than they will, a person, another family member that maybe they only see, you know, twice a year or once a year at Christmas, mm-hmm. Whereas that pet is part of their family every single day.
What kind of advice do you have for people who may have lost a pet recently?
I absolutely advise that that we do not ignore that. They go through the five stages of grief, just like we do with any other kind of situation, and that they understand that it takes time to work through that. My husband and I lost a cat at a young age due to a heart disease. So he was mm-hmm. 3 years old, and we knew he had heart disease, and we were treating that. But still, his death was very sudden, and he was only 3 years old. And there were absolutely people who didn't understand. Oh, he's just a cat, or, well, you knew he was sick anyway, so this was bound to happen eventually. And no. I mean, it was absolutely a tragic loss. And even both being veterinarians, my husband and I still mourned that loss, you know, very significantly.
Mm-hmm. And what about advice for people who have more than one pet in the household? And as you say, pets are going to grieve one way or the other.
Right. So you need to just make that transition as smooth as you can and give attention to the one that's left behind. And, you know, some people will get another companion, but we encourage them not to make the mistake of trying to replace that first pet necessarily, or to mm-hmm. think that first pet is going to fill that hole in the same way. We were talking recently with some other professionals about the my first dog syndrome, because as professionals, we often hear stories about, well, my first dog was, you know, perfect, and my first dog did all of these amazing things, and now this dog. And sometimes it's just that, you know, fuzzy memory that you don't remember that the first dog as a puppy also ate your shoes, right? And so we hear about that first dog syndrome. So in moving forward, you need to understand that your next pet is not going to be the same as your first pet. And yet you still can have a different relationship with that one as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what's next, Tom? This seems like a kind of a growing and evolving field, especially thinking about the psychology of pet ownership as much as the kind of physical needs that pets have.
Yeah, so there's really two things. One is we're intensely focused on getting word out about the human-animal bond certification and making sure that consumers, pet parents know about that, so they know that their veterinarian has connectivity to that. But we're also focused as well on this other piece that Dr. Honickman brought up, which is the incredible levels of stress that veterinarians are going through mm-hmm. because of what we call compassion fatigue. That's what she was alluding to when she talked about this whole issue of the fact that a typical veterinarian has to put down, you know, all these animals each week. So right now, veterinarians have one of the highest rates of suicide of any profession.
Really?
It's very, very bad. It's a tough situation that we're dealing with. And there's a whole bunch of factors combined into that. Compassion fatigue is one of them. The fact that they are these brilliant doctors who come out and aren't taught how to run businesses, but they're essentially small business folk in many cases. So there's all these different stressors and the dynamics of the economy and what vets make and student debt.
And the fact that most veterinarians are type A personality perfectionists, and actually that's what the vet schools look for.
I wasn't going to say that. You're a veterinarian.
I will admit it. I'm a full-blood card-carrying member of the Perfectionist Society. And so the vet schools choose this personality. And then we get into the veterinary industry, and often we're not allowed to do what we know we can due to a variety of factors, due to client finances. Mm-hmm. Some people might bring in a very young animal that was hit by a car and has a broken leg, which is something we absolutely can fix, but maybe that client can't afford to fix it, or there's something else going on in that household and they just can't emotionally deal with that trauma. Or
Lynn, all of these challenges that vets are facing, people still want to go to veterinary school and become a vet, do what you're doing?
They still do. And I do encourage it. I think that if somebody is passionate about this profession, then there are a lot of things they can do once they do have their veterinary degree. You can go into general practice, but you can also go into research. You could go into government work and industry, all of the different species. So you could go into zoo work, or you could go into large animal food production and things like that. So if somebody comes to me and says, hey, my high school age or my middle school son wants to be a vet, I'll have a serious talk, and we do talk about the cost risk benefits and that vet schools are quite expensive.
Is it the same as getting a medical degree?
Right. So it's often 8 years, 4 years of undergrad, and then mm-hmm. 4 years of vet school.
And then you've got to specialize in whatever animal.
Right. And a lot
of people say harder.
Yeah. Because we're learning all the species,
right?
Not just humans. It's a long journey. And then when you get out, you're making significantly less income than a human doctor with huge debt. So there are veterinarians who are graduating with at least $100,000 in debt and up to $300,000 in debt.
Yeah.
And how do you dig out from that if your only starting salary is $60,000 a year?
What is the most unusual pet you've ever treated?
So I worked actually wildlife rehab, so I can I've seen quite a lot of different animals. Chicago area, I did a lot of raptors and hawks and owls and things like that. Mm-hmm. Pet wise, I think people are. I think steering away from the crazy, ridiculous exotics. We used to see a lot of sugar gliders, I think, was the exotic pet.
That's like a kind of a squirrel.
It's like a flying squirrel.
Right.
Yeah. So we would see sugar gliders and ferrets and things like that. I think more and more people are realizing that these exotic animals are quite a lot of work.
Thinking about everything you've said about what it's like to be a vet and all of the kind of stress you go through, are there some cases that kind of stick in your mind, like you sort of mull over and think, if only I'd done this or if only I'd done that?
So for me as a behavior vet, on the slang lines that Tom was saying that maybe there's going to be this shortage of pets, I think that I would amend that by saying maybe a shortage of quality pets.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because I think that what's happening is that our shelters, many shelters are full of mm-hmm. pets with troubles.
Mm-hmm.
And so so the cases that I mull over and really mourn are the ones that typical family goes to the shelter on a weekend and says, we're going to add a dog to our family, and this is the right time, and we're planned, and we researched it, and we're ready. And they adopt this dog from the shelter, and they get home, and it has a lot of behavior issues because we don't know their history. I always mm-hmm. tell my clients, I wish they could come in with their biography in their pocket and say, okay, here's what happened to me, and here's all the baggage that I'm carrying around. And for me especially, the problem is that by the time I see the troubled pet, they've gone down a wrong path already. And so they've gotten information.
It sounds like a wayward kid.
The family has gotten information and advice from anybody other than the behavior veterinarian.
And they probably just Googled it, right?
Right. So they Google it and they talk to their neighbor and they talk to the employee at the pet store and they talk to and they look online and they watch television and they see celebrity trainers and things like that. And so they fall into the whole dominance myth idea and they fall into aversive training. Well, if this dog is aggressive, then he needs a tough hand, which is actually the opposite. So, the aggressive dog is actually feeling quite threatened and we need to, again, like I said, change that emotional response, not punish it. Mm. And so by the time I see these families, they've already spent thousands of dollars unfortunately, with the wrong methods.
And then they're coming to you and saying, you've got to fix this because this is the end of the line
right.
for me.
So often, yes, I would have to say that, you know, a majority of my patients say that I am the last resort, mm-hmm. which is a lot of pressure to have yep. on somebody. And then they'll say, and we've already spent X, Y, and Z, and so you need to fix this quickly and not expensively. Mm. And so that really is tough because this is a journey. This is not something I'm going to fix in a two-hour session. This is something that's going to require months to years of change, and the whole family needs to understand that. And so then we also get into a little bit of family counseling because, you know, maybe dad's on board, but mom's not quite quite enamored of the fact that the dog is growling at the children.
So you have to know a little bit of human psychology,
Absolutely. Too. We often feel like we need to have our marriage counseling degree as well.
Dr. Lynn Honickman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me today.
I'm also joined by Tom Bonn. He is the CEO of the NAVC. Thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
And that interview first aired last July. Coming up, Benoit Glaser built a concert hall in his house. Now he wants to build a floating concert hall. We'll listen back to a conversation with the co-founder of the Tsimikwa Arts Foundation about making chamber music more accessible and about the boat he calls Benoit's Ark. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Benoit Glaser is Tsimikwa's co-founder. The 100-seat concert venue that showcases the work of local and international artists is also his home. Glaser's aim in showcasing art and music at the Tsimikwa White House is to make it accessible to a wide audience. And he has an even more ambitious plan to build a floating concert hall, a plan he's nicknamed Benoit's Ark. I caught up with Glaser at his house. Do you have a high season and a low season as far as performances at the White House?
We have several. So because we don't close very long during the summer, for example, some of our busiest times are in August because there's nothing else happening. And so we are a little bit more flexible because we're smaller. We close for 2 weeks in the holidays at Christmas time. We close for another 2 weeks in July, late July. And then we actually this year are going to close in September for 2 weeks just because that we found out through the years that that is a low time for us just because of everyone else is starting up again. And so there's a lot of events, you know. And so we try to steer clear of other organizations' events when we can, of course. But, you know, we have 90 this year, so it becomes difficult, you know. And that's just at the house, and that's just the actual public concerts. We have lots more happening.
90 concerts. So is this like more than a typical season for you?
Well, this is the, you know, this is the most we've ever had, but this is a natural and logical growth pattern that we've had in the past few years just because it went from a hobby for me to a full-time job.
And are you getting more people coming to you because they're hearing more about the White House and maybe more artists are kind of sharing the news about this venue and this opportunity to perform?
Well, so you asked two questions there, really. The audience-wise, like, it varies, right? So because we have more and more events, we have Saturday afternoon events now, we have, like, so many things happening, we serve a lot more people. But, you know, as we found out the first time we closed for 2 weeks, there's a bump in attendance after that. Like, so in other words, you know, the market still is still pretty small, even though we're a small venue. Orlando's still a small city. And so there's eventually, like, you know, per event at 90 events a year, we don't expect every event to be as full as if we had, you know, 60 events a year, just because of the virtue of the fact that, you know, our regulars, for example, sometimes there's big things happening that we cannot circumvent, like, you know, Hamilton came to town, obviously our regulars went to that because, you know, they have access to our place more times than they have access to Hamilton, you know, obviously. So, but the other question you asked is from the performance aspect, and that is definitely a growing, like, it's a strong growth. Like, our waiting list is growing rapidly just because we can't fit everybody, even though we're growing our number of events. And so right now, like, I have people who insisted on booking up to the end of 2021. Like, it's pretty crazy. We try to keep it to about 16, 18 months at the most.
Has it changed the kinds of performers who want to come play here? Like, are you getting a different kind of class of performers or quality as the reputation of the Timucua Arts Foundation grows?
There is no doubt about it. So essentially, like, there's two ways that the growth of our reputation happens, right? There's word of mouth, and then there's, like, you know, national and international media outlets. And so both of those are growing. One just for virtue of the fact that we've been operating for so many years, and now, you know, and every time somebody comes from New York City or, you know, Japan or Europe, they go back where they came from and they tell people, their peers, about us. And so their peers contact us because they want to perform there the next time they're in US. And so that's like a slow, steady growth that's been happening for, you know, more like essentially about 15 years, you know. It's, and the other side of that is you know, our being covered by more and more national and international media. So, you know, we showed up in the New York Times last year, and that there was a big bump in the performers, like world-class performers from the New York area, who suddenly contacted us, people who had maybe had not talked to people who had already performed here. And so that, like, created a big bump.
Benmaya Glazer, have you been to other countries which have similar kind of venues like this, sort of performance spaces inside people's homes, essentially?
Yes, I have. I performed a lot throughout Europe in the late 80s and 90s, but no situation was exactly like ours. And so, and that's fine, you know, that's like, and we're told, like, every time by, you know, musicians from all over the world who you know, obviously have different experiences than I have and have, you know, played in different places. And so, and over, people tell us that this is a unique place. And so I'm starting to believe it. I did play, like, I've played in castles, I've played in barns, you know, like in high level, high, you know, highly equipped, you know, but nothing that was, you know, as far as the soundproofing, as far as the, you know, the setup, the acoustic setup, you know, and the fact that it's in a home. So, you know, I've played in mansions before, and, you know, lots of people play house concerts. There's actually, like, networks in the U.S. Where people, that's all they do, play house concerts. And, mm-hmm. and some of those people have played here, and they told me, it's like, that, you know, there's nothing like that anywhere in the U.S. And I would tend to say that there's really nothing exactly like that anywhere in the world.
You're kind of a perfectionist, right? So you had the opportunity to design a performance space that is to your specifications.
Exactly. So I am a little bit OCD, and I'm a little bit, you know, I like to research things, and, like, if, whether I'm purchasing a piece of equipment or I'm going to design, you know, obviously the bigger the project, the more attention to detail I give it. And so, yes, the answer is yes. I am a little bit OCD. I'm a little bit, some people would use different words to describe my attention to detail. And, you know, but obviously this, you know, this represents my wife and I's entire life savings. Of course, I did my best to design a place that was well suited for chamber arts in general.
Last time we spoke, I was asking you about another project that you kind of have on the back burner, I guess, the floating concert hall. What's happening with that?
Well, it's basically in the same spot as it was when we last spoke, in that it's ready to go, except that the Timucua Arts Foundation and the house, the future is not 100%. Like, in other words, I want to develop an endowment to ensure the long-term sustainability and future of the Timucua Arts Foundation. When that's done and the house is secured and, you know, either paid off or close to that, or, like, I don't have to worry about it anymore, then I'm going to go on the coast for a few weeks and raise the money that I need to do for the, I call it Benoit's Ark. But whatever name it takes, it will probably take somebody, a big donor's name at some point, which is fine with me.
So you've got the designs. Have you thought ahead to a boat builder or somebody who can actually bring this work to life?
Oh, yeah. The design is done. Naval Architect has gone through the design and has approved it and, you know, basically gave me his feedback on my design, which I have nothing to change. So that was very good. But there was a few little details, like I overestimated the draft, which is great because I want as low a draft as possible. So I was 6 inches off. according to his calculation. But
and just for people who maybe aren't so much in the know, the draft is how deep it sinks in the water.
Yes, how deep the boat's going to go. Because in other words, how deep does the water have to be for the boat to actually float and not run aground? And so I thought it was going to be 48 inches, and the naval architect says it should be 42 inches, which is very, very good for me because everywhere that we're looking at docking to have concert, that's the principle of this thing. This thing would be like it would go on a little weekly tour that would complement the performance at the house. And so the group would come to the house, have a concert here, and then go on the boat and then do four or five performances for the rest of the week, so that it would be a much more interesting experience for the performers. Not to mention probably more economically feasible, and it would certainly make it more attractive for bigger names in the performing arts to come and play, and so we can attract more, even better performers. And then the idea is that we would stop in a public pier or dock, and where there's free parking, and then people would come on the boat just for the performance, and then get off the boat, and then we'd go to the next destination. And this is a solar powered boat, no fuel on board. It's very cool and a sustainable project environmentally, as well as I think economically and culturally. And so so knowing that, like, basically that's the idea. I have a builder lined up there on Lake Superior, and so they would build the boat. It's an aluminum boat. It's not like your typical sheet metal construction. It's a framed construction with a double hull. That's to allow me to soundproof the boat as best I can and control the acoustics inside as best I can. And so basically it's a 200-seat version of the 100-seat auditorium that we have in our home, except that it's on a boat, which would become our home, or somebody's home. If it's not me, it would be somebody else. In fact, the idea has already caught on, in the sense that as soon as I build the first one in the Tampa Bay area, there is somebody who wants to run the same thing in the San Francisco Bay area. And then I've already had some inquiries about other, like, franchises, quote unquote, or copies of the project elsewhere. And so there's so much coastline in this country alone, not to mention in the world. Like, I mean, majority of the world's people live close to the ocean at some point, or a large body of water. And so definitely it makes sense to have a venue. Of course, what we're all about at the Tim Quartz Foundation is inspiring the world to create and learn through intimate experiences of the performing and visual arts. And so the idea is to promote an ideal, or magical, or you want to say memorable, whatever adjective you want to put to it, experience for the audience and the performers in a chamber arts world. And so we, in the smaller kind of performing arts world. And so the house makes sense for that. And we perform elsewhere. The Alterity Chamber Orchestra, our own new music resident chamber orchestra, it's a 16 or 17 piece, depending on the program. We play in different places. The percussion setup's too large for the house. The stage is not big enough. So we go in the community and play, like, in warehouses and bars even. Like, we've done it at the ballet's old building. We might do it in the ballet's new building when it's done. The idea is to bring a high-quality new music from living composers to places so that it's not a stuffy experience. And that's actually what brought us to the attention of the New York Times, is that fact that we're trying to make chamber arts accessible to everyone, regardless of your socioeconomic status or whatever your cultural consumption habits are. And so, in other words, this is not your typical, like, tuxedo dressing up kind of thing for that. And the house is the same thing. Like, you dress like you dress. I mean, come as you are, come enjoy a magical evening of music and visual arts or play or whatever it is that we are doing that night. And it's, for us, important to make it accessible. Our Saturday afternoon concerts, the idea is to make it easy for young families in the Saturday afternoon case, to go out, because, usually they have to find a sitter, all that stuff. Now they can just bring their kids, and we encourage them to bring their kids and expose their young children to good quality music and visual arts.
So the boat, once it's built, is kind of an extension of that, coming to a dock near you.
Yes, exactly. And the fact that it's mobile is great for the performer. performers. It's not that important for the audience point of view, but there's two different kind of ways to look at it. It's, for me, it's an economic factor, is that instead of spending $1 billion on a major, you know, performing arts building, set of buildings or whatever, and then people have to go there wherever they live, right? It centralizes this. We're decentralized because we can go to you. And that's what we want to bring to them, is like good quality music of all kinds, plays, all kinds of stuff right where they live. And whether you live in Tampa or Sarasota or Clearwater, whatever, even though there might be a big, huge, shiny building nearby, we're going to be able to, you know, basically attract a different kind of people because we're making it accessible to all.
Well, Benoit Glazer, founder of the Timucua Arts Foundation, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me on.
That interview first aired in April. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Elizabeth Gondar. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We have less than $100,000 to raise to make our $350,000 goal in this fall silent drive. Your support is what keeps local programs like Intersection on the air. So if you've already made a contribution, thanks. If not, please consider a gift of support in any amount. $10, $20, or even $50 a month helps support our local reporting and the programs from NPR like Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Call 1-800-785-2020 or go to wmfe.org/support. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.